Welcome to We Empower, the radio show that inspires you to embrace your potential, resilience, and strength. In these challenging times, we're here to help you unlock your power to overcome obstacles, pursue your dreams, and shape a brighter future. I'm Annabelle Tennis, your host for this empowering hour. Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of We Empower. I'm thrilled to have you all with us today. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired. Let's make today count. And I'm very happy to have today's radio show from my side here from Sparrow Hills, a very nice location where we had already a radio guest sitting exactly here where I'm sitting now. So in today's episode, we will have two great women here to introduce. It is Agata Hakura. First of all, she's a CFO by day, climate activist by heart, game industry leader, mother of two, future shaper. Meet Agata Hakura, where strategy meets purpose. And then I'm very, very happy to say hello and welcome to Alia. Alia, from graphic design to Michelin kitchens, fermentation to future food, Alia shows how culture, craft, and sustainability become a way of life. Happy to have you here. So first of all, we will start with a song. And afterwards, we continue with Alia Tarasieva. Welcome here in the show, Alia.
Thank you, Annabelle. Thanks for having me.
Some people design objects, others' design system. Other designs culture through food, fermentation, design, and care for the planet. From the studios of Hamburg and London to the kitchens of Otto Lange, from community farms to biotech labs, from wild foraging to academic research, her work connects taste, identity, and responsibility. And a world obsessed with speed, all your works with time, with microbes, seasons, patience, and meaning. Today we talk about food as memory, fermentation as resistance, and why the future of sustainability starts in the smallest daily rituals. Alia, I would like to start in your childhood, because often there are starts, and if we talk with the symbol of seeds, then childhood often places the seeds, right? When you were a child, what was your first memory of food that meant something?
That's a bit of a question. Thank you. I feel much of my work is actually built on memory and memories. And when I think back at my childhood, it was sunny days and basically connecting seasons and memories to our house in the countryside that my grandparents founded in the 70s, and a garden that has been flourishing and just giving fruits. And accompanying all that process throughout the year has been something that really deeply shaped me. And part of that was also helping, without knowing that, my grandma ferment. She would send me to the garden, pick blackcurrant leaves. And I didn't know back then, comparing to now, that they're rich with tannins and those are biochemical compounds that keep your cucumbers crispy. But then that kind of knowledge has been engraved into my body from back then.
That sounds really like a childhood full of senses and full of just getting everything from everywhere and just collecting on a kind of growing up. What did food represent for you? Comfort, creativity, survival, maybe even rebellion?
That's a beautiful question. Back then, it represented to me connection, gatherings together, and culture in a big way, because we have traces of Ukrainian culture, we have Jewish culture in our family, we have some culture from Middle East, from the Far East, and all those stories and narratives have been woven into food, and this was almost a language that we spoke.
It's great that you mentioned this, because, for example, taking the Jewish culture, food is something which is combined very much with rituals. What you're allowed to eat, when you're allowed to eat, how you're allowed to eat, what you're allowed to touch before or after. Did you already question ways or rules how things are done as a child?
In a different way. I mean, I'm neurodivergent. I'm super, super sensitive. So I had other ways of restriction rather than connected to food. It was less about it was more about how to eat, as of do not play with food and appreciate food and all of those things that, like, I guess are very universal for every child. And our way of expressing ourselves through food, or in my family, it was a way to tell where people came from, where the ancestors came from. And those stories were told through ingredients. So I would know what raisins have to do in a bowl of rice, or why we have some components in the dishes, because there was like a cultural meaning to that. And that meaning also, again, told stories from movements, from maybe even displacement. But there was a poetry that was put into it, maybe some poetic element of survival that was put into food.
Oh, that sounds really like food could be something which is a symbol for a lot of things. And interestingly, you said you are very sensitive. So it's very close that you started in graphic design to give things a picture, to give ideas a volume, to give perceptions a room. What did design teach you that still guides your cooking?
Definitely ratio and proportions of, in design, you often work with proportions of geometrical objects, but in food, I can take it to another level and think of proportions of textures, temperatures, flavors, how does acidity relate to fattiness? And I feel it just gain more depth through cooking. And but design is so inevitable, and it's just a big part of everything I am, be it through furniture, fashion, jewelry. I collect literally paper and colors still at home just because of textures and colors.
And what made you leave the screen, or what made you leave the graphic design? Because I can imagine it can be very fulfilling. I studied product design, and creating something out of the blue is always interesting. What made you leave that and enter a really professional kitchen and say yes to one, and in this situation also no to the other?
Thank you. I felt graphic design in particular, for example, comparing to product design, I felt it limiting because it's limited to a two-dimensional world, world that it does not go beyond like a screen or a page. And yeah, I felt just very limited on the one hand, but the other very, very important aspect to me was that I lacked in my sense purpose, and I was searching for purpose, and I was searching for a way to express myself that goes beyond me as a person and does not contribute maybe to just another brand in a way that it only makes more sales, for example, and it's something that is universal and accessible to everyone. Comparing to graphic design, where you tell a story of a product, which can be a great product that you want to support with your work, I felt that it does not contribute sort of like to healing of people or shaping minds in a certain way. And I spent quite some time, maybe for 1.5 years, I've been looking for something else, and I've tried all the classical hobbies of every creative. I did pottery, I did flowers. I was looking for a canvas, and so many friends of mine who are also designers, who are graphic designers, they would go for pottery, for sewing. They would try to do some textile work, or like do like a jewelry making workshop. I've been there, I've done that, but nothing felt deep enough and kind of like purposeful enough. And food seemed to me a way where I can combine both purpose, meaning, nourishment on an like all-encompassing way, and still aesthetics.
I can absolutely imagine, because you have directly the interaction, you have directly also the follow-up from the people who give you a yes, no, how I feel. You satisfy them. You might satisfy them in a kind. You're feeding them, but you are giving them more. You're giving them ideas for their life, ideas for how to eat, how to live, how to treat others. Food is something where I completely can imagine why you've chosen that, where you can really see straight ahead how the people react on something, and where you can bring people straight ahead together around one table, right? If you think about moments in your kitchen, what was the most humbling moment in a kitchen that really changed you?
Those, for the most part, probably were people who then became my mentors. I remember this first job interview with a very famous chef, Andreas Rieger. He was back then founder and head chef of Eins unter Null, which was acclaimed the Noma of Germany. And I remember having this first conversation with him on a phone call, and he said, before I do anything, I'll look at it and I question it. And he brought this example saying, okay, if I want to cook a humble potato, which is the most simple ingredient ever, right? Or one of the most simplest, He said, I'll look at it and I'm having a conversation, literally with a potato. I'm asking it, how does it alter when I cook it? How does it alter when I fry it? What does it have to offer? And I loved it so much because he said, my job is not to cook what I think I can. It's not like expressing me and my mind, but highlighting and almost curating what or showcasing what a potato is capable of. And there was no potato on the menu, obviously. I didn't know the norm of Germany, but he just brought this like most probably humble vegetable, right? That you would think that is cheap. That is kind of like quote unquote poor people food, and it's quote unquote unhealthy. And that has completely changed me because exactly he brought this very simple example and said, our job is to showcase what an ingredient is capable of. And it was humbling in a way that it gave space for you as a chef, as a world-acclaimed chef, to step back. And not to think from a place of ego, but to think from a place of curation and being a medium.
That's interesting. I just, while you were talking about this, thought, yes, I mean, food is something which comes from nature, which is a part of nature as we do, as we are. So, eating is connecting us again with the nature and with all what, what this mother planet has grown for us, is offering us, right? How did working with sustainability pioneers like POCO or farm to table chefs, shape your ethics?
Thank you so much for this question. It was the most organically grown or established pathway that I could have because I didn't look for it. It was literally the first job that I got was in UK's most sustainable restaurant of the year. So maybe from because I don't know, maybe I do believe in manifestation and I do believe that you can walk your talk in a way that if you're being a person who grew up with a garden, who had a garden herself, who literally carries a sense of awe and wonder for nature, it came inevitably that I worked there and it was just a very natural and logical but never forced extension of who I was. However, it rather felt very aligned. I was surprised that those kind of restaurants exist, those restaurants like Poco that source their ingredients just from 80 miles away from not just London, but 80 miles away from the location of the restaurant, which might seem limiting when you understand that you don't need sugar because you just need to reduce beetroot juice. You don't need chocolate because you work with carob beans. And I never felt sustainability as something that is restricting. It actually ignited my imagination even more. And I would always say it's a place, it's a matter of mindset, how you see it. We are just trained to be very, maybe even lazy in our thinking sometimes that we think there's no dessert can exist without chocolate, or no curd can exist without lemon, and no great cocktails can exist without the grapefruit, for example. But then you find yourself in those places that see sustainability not as restriction, but as a big playground.
That's right. So Alia will tell us after the break how food can widen our perspective even more with some practices she's in and she developed. So please stay tuned because after the commercial break, we will continue our conversation.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach. Here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Olya, we already talked a little bit about fermentation. Why is fermentation such a powerful metaphor for society today?
That's a beautiful question, and I'm happy that you see it in a similar way. It is a metaphor for society because we have been engraving our culture, resilience, and creativity through this practice. It's fermentation is something that has been here longer than cooking. Basically, it's the slowest way of cooking. It's been with us from across Mediterranean to Asia and Africa since over 10,000 years. And it's been a practice of finding answers in seemingly limitations, as of having too much milk, for example, or having too much meat, and then asking yourself, what shall we do with having caught, for example, too much fish and having excess of produce in one season and then having lack of it in another. And today I'm very happy that we are rediscovering it because we are facing so many fundamental global challenges, be it lack of water, be it very unsustainable ways of farming and producing leather, for example, right? Food injustice, and yeah, just to name a few, all the sustainable practices that we can now foster can be done with fermentation because it's a self-preserving method. It's a natural way to increase and amplify all the natural nourishing compounds in anything. And it naturally increases when it comes to food, the levels of vitamins, micronutrients, the bioavailability of any product on the one hand. On the other hand, it's a very, very low key almost and low energy method to produce new products, for example, meat substitutes made from mycelium or made from scraps of food, something that is apparently left over, and you take it, you put it in a very simple salt solution, and then what you get is a product that is extremely beneficial for the gut microbiome, that doesn't take much energy, doesn't cost water, doesn't cost electricity, barely cost any electricity. You can produce it across the globe with minimal resources and provide, again, nourishing products, be it vegan leather or meat substitutes or dairy substitutes across the globe. And it's also a way to fight for justice.
We're talking now about fermentation as if everybody of our listeners and people who watch us know what fermentation is. And maybe most of them know what it is. Indeed, it is that you that you are part of a product changing, right? You see and how a product changes by the support of microbes. And it is a kind of process you can watch, right? If I think now about it, it needs, of course, a special location where you do put this. It needs a special environment. It needs some special timing you need to have in mind. How does fermentation reconnect people with time in a hyper-accelerator world?
I love that. As I was saying earlier, it's the slowest way of cooking when it comes to cooking. You basically take, again, a humble cabbage and you add some salt, you put it in a vessel, and then you wait. And I think what it teaches us is that our job is not to force something or like to force to always try to force an outcome, that our job as people oftentimes could also be, and also as creatives, to create a nourishing environment where something can grow. And there's nothing, and what I particularly like about fermentation is that I can't force it. I can't speed it up. There's absolutely no way to make sauerkraut in 2 days. It just doesn't work. I have to wait at least 5 to 10 days. And this makes me feel humble. And it also reminds me that not everything that is great should be available 24/7. And I like the aspect of care, again, when we speak about how does it transform people. I like the aspect of caretaking of it and taking care of yourself, because self-care is such a big word, no? Taking care of yourself by actually practicing, stepping back, creating the perfect conditions for something nourishing to be there for you, and being patient. Observing also your product, how it alters over the course of a week or two.
It's fantastic how you understand food as much more as a kind of metaphor for our life. And of course, it's completely understandable that reducing food waste is also part of your work. And you did it reducing food waste by over 80% in one project. Unbelievable. Great. What is the biggest sustainability myth in modern food culture, you would say?
Thank you for that question. Let me have a think. Off the top of my head, I guess one of the, not biggest, but I would say there are a few probably quote-unquote healthy food that is packed in plastic, quote-unquote fermented food that's been pasteurized and where all the bacteria has been eliminated, quote-unquote healthy food that, like matcha, that is amazing, it's high in antioxidants, and we have it in the Western world. But it is in a long, if you zoom out, it causes environmental problems on the other side of the world, because the demand is so high that we can't fulfill it. So I guess the biggest sustainability myth is that we are being sold products that are indeed healthy for our bodies, but the production and the supply chain is not healthy for the planet. So a healthy diet can only be, in my opinion, the so-called planetary health diet. And it's a way of eating that is beneficial for me as a human being, and it's also beneficial for all the resources, water, soil, transportation, social conditions for other people, and labor justice.
Absolutely, Oliver. I only can sign this. But on the other hand, I think some people might listen to us and think, oh my God, food, eating, this is getting really complicated. How can I know that, for example, matcha needs a lot of water or needs a lot of environment, that, for example, rainforest is taken just to build plantage for this and that? Don't I need to be a scientist or somebody or a journalist going there checking out how can I eat with can I eat when I have little time, small kitchen, and I want to eat more circular. How can I do this in an easy way to not knowing all political circumstances and water conditions and being an expert for all these foods details?
Absolutely. This is a brilliant question. I also consult people on when it comes to their gut health. And there is this quote, do not eat anything that your grandma wouldn't eat. It might be a brilliant and very simple and profane and yet complex answer, because it not only means maybe do not eat something that's been put in a shape that this product has never been into, like crisps, because this is just not how a potato grows. This is one response to that. However, there is a beautiful aspect of seasonality, and this is something very, very simple. And it relates to our grandmothers in a way that our gut microbiome is co-shaped by where we come from. So when I come from Ukraine, my gut microbiome is co-shaped by what not only I grew up with, but also by what my ancestors have been growing up with. It means that we didn't have kiwis or pineapples in winter. So maybe if I want to balance out vitamins, I might buy into this narrative, but in fact, I actually don't really need it. So this would be something very simple, maybe just thinking to be practical. What have your ancestors have been eating? This could be one approach, but also just going to a farmer's market if there's one accessible to you, or to a supermarket and looking at, without being too precise, do products come from at least the country you live in or the area, maybe a neighbor country where you live in? When it comes to eating healthy in a busy, fast-paced life or working from home office, not wanting to get your food delivered, I would say there's a very simple way. This is how I organize my lunch. There are healthy grains or semi-grains. There's fiber. There's some ferments. There's a tiny bit of maybe kimchi or anything else, capers. And then there is a simple protein that I made in bulk earlier the week, for example, cooking beans that are extremely beneficial for your gut microbiome, cooking 1 kilo of beans, having them ready, having a bit of salad, some canola, a healthy oil, is very simple. So I oftentimes think meals in modular systems. And then what is good for my body? Do I have something fatty, acidic, protein, sweet, sour?
This is really great, and I think your idea also to go back with your ancestors, this can be very, very surprising, especially if you come from multinational families, right? I mean, I'm thinking just from my family, my father's side, who ate a lot of meat, ate a lot of bread, and the family of my grandmother, of my mother's side, who ate very Mediterranean, a lot of fruits, vegetables, no meat, fresh fish. So I would take this side. That's much better, I think, for my gut.
It sounds better. It sounds like a Mediterranean diet, which is then going back us right to blue zones.
Exactly. Maybe we can add that we not only have to look at our ancestors, but also at their job, what they did. If they did a lot of handcrafting, or if they did a lot of with their brain, where different eating styles might be also good.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you have to stay creative and you have a job where you have to organize a lot of things, not only you in your life, but a lot of things around you. How do you stay creative without burning out? Do you have some rituals over the day?
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much. I have to be honest, and I have to say that same as a ferment, I cannot aim to put myself in a grid and stay perfectly organized. And even me as a person who educates on healthy habits, healthy diet, has a yoga teacher's certificate, I do have a crispy burnout once every 2 years, probably. So I have to be just honest. And it happens from exactly from maybe trying to be too creative, diving into too many things, being overly excited about work. But what helps me stay organized and creative are exactly those rituals that you're saying. I need a slow morning. And as a person who's 10% British, I need a really, really long time of maybe 45 minutes just drinking Earl Grey every morning, looking out of the windows, watching the clouds pass by. And this is something that is so sacred to me. If I have to take a plane at 5 a.m., I would wake up at 3:50 just to have that ritual. I would do anything to keep that. Just making consciously those breaks in between, I guess, understanding what your body can carry, how your brain works, finding a way to organize tasks, be it maybe boxing, tasking, or anything else, and finding a way to make my neurodivergent brain, I guess, run in the most effective way. And that can be different every day. But yeah, note taking, a VOOP, a time management app, and also allowing some space for, deliberately allowing space for chaos, because this is sometimes where something surprising and creative can arise.
Yes, I'm absolutely with you. I want to ask you, unfortunately, the last question. I mean, you are speaking so much with food, you're living so much with food. If food were a language, what would you like to say with your work?
Thank you. This is so poetic. Thank you so much for this question. What I would like to say is love is simple. I guess that is it. And there's nothing complicated about feeling connected, feeling pleasure. It can be literally a humble carrot that you've took the perfect sweetness out of it. And I guess that is it. Beauty is just simple and it's accessible to everyone. Care is simple. Love is simple. And it's very straightforward. And you can just be there for it.
Thank you very much, Olga. Thank you very much also for reminding us that the future isn't only coded in labs or designed in offices. It's also bubbling quietly in jars, growing slowly in soil, and living in the choices we make every day. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So after a small commercial break of approximately 2 minutes, we will continue with Agata.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Today on We Empower, we meet now a woman who proves that numbers can change industries and values can shape systems. She's a co-founder and CFO of a 200-plus people game studio navigating multi-million euro productions. She's also a climate activist, ensuring the next generation inherits not just opportunity, but safety. A strategist in a creative industry, a leader in a male-dominated field, a mother raising children in multiple languages and multiple futures. Her name is Agata Haikura, and her story is about courage, clarity, and choosing impact over comfort. Welcome here in the show, Agata.
Hi. Hello, everybody. Thank you, Annabelle, for having me here.
So, Agata, we could, I think, spend here hours about your life and your mission. But if we start with your family, what values did your family pass on that still guide your decisions today?
Mm-hmm. So I had a really great childhood. My parents taught me to be open-minded and to always assume good intentions in other people. And that's what I always do. I always assume that somebody has a good intention. And they also taught me to be open to whatever the life brings, even if sometimes it's uncomfortable. I'm like, okay, this is hard. I have a hard situation here, but what can I learn from this? Or what doors might this open to me? And this is the mindset that helped me a lot in my career and in my activism and also in my motherhood.
Yeah. When did you first feel a sense of calling rather than just ambition?
Yeah, thank you for this question, because honestly, I have never had a calling, and I would like to normalize that in here, because we very often we hear these stories of people who knew exactly from their young age what they want to do in their life, what they are born for, or they just wake up one day and they realize what they want to do. And wow, that's great if somebody has it like this, but that's not for most people. And it wasn't also for me. And for me, it's more like I explore, I learn, I build new skills until something sticks and something feels meaningful. And then I dig deeper and I keep learning all the time. And I think that passion to what you do is not something that you can find somewhere. This is something you just develop. And there are two great books on this that I can really recommend. One is So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport. And the other one is Greed by Angela Duckworth. And they confirmed what I just lived, that you don't need a magical moment in your life to achieve something. You don't need to be creative or innovative or just brilliant, because you can have a great life. You can build a life that you're proud of just through consistency, through hard work. And even if sometimes it feels boring, if there are any setbacks or there are these unsexy parts of the life that nobody wants to talk about, you still can build something that is meaningful and that you can be just proud of. Yeah.
That sounds good. What mistake in your early career taught you the most?
So this relates a little bit to what I've just said, because my biggest early career mistake was to stay in one position for too long. I started as a financial auditor in one of the big four companies, and I stayed there for 6 or 7 years. And I really appreciate this experience. I'm very grateful for it, because it taught me discipline. It taught me some standards. It taught me to deliver on deadlines, etc., etc. Everything that a big corporation can teach you. But But like after three or 4 years, I understood that it's not the place where I want to be for the whole life or my whole career. And but I still stayed there, and because it felt easier, it paid well, of course, and it felt a little bit uncomfortable to change. So the lesson here is that if you feel that you're not developing yourself, that you're not satisfied with something, just change early, change, experiment, and just look for something else that can inspire you, right? So, and here I am right now after this couple of years, and I'm in a position of being a founder of a company in video games industry where I take care of finance, and I'm really satisfied with this.
Is it also is it the more being entrepreneur, or is it more being in a leading finance role in a creative industry, which is giving you this moment of feeling more alive? Sorry that I ask you that, but I feel that this comes out of the answer you just gave me.
Yeah, it's both. I would say it's both because this is a very creative industry, and I love this contrast there because the people that I'm surrounded with are so creative, and my job is to bring some structure to this creativity and to put some financial framework to some financial frames to their work. So I love both of this.
Can you explain what kind of games you are developing?
Yeah, for now we mostly work for other studios. We back in the time we also created our own games. For now we work on the IPs of other studios. Unfortunately, right now I cannot tell what games exactly we're working on right now. Recently we developed a game called Painkiller, and there were also other titles. We work in different genres with RPGs being our the genre being in our heart the most.
Is it more for kids or for adults, the games
No,
you?
it's for adults. Definitely for adults. These are the games for PC and consoles.
Interesting. And do you play them also on your own or your kids?
Okay, I have to admit that I'm not a player. I play from time to time, but I'm not that passionate about playing video games. I'm more passionate about having this studio than playing games. And my kids play the games, but not these ones, of course, because we have games for adults. My kids play the games for kids, yeah.
On the one hand, you're in game development. On the other hand, you're in taking action against the bad development of climate. How does this comes together, and why was climate action not optional for you, but really inevitable?
Yeah, it doesn't come together for now. This is something totally separate because, and it started very simple. Once I just randomly came across an article about climate changes, how it works and how it will impact our future, and especially the future of the next generations. And I had a baby, a little baby at home then, and I was pregnant with the other one. So I just felt that I cannot sit still and wait until this works out somehow magically. And back then I learned about a movement called Parents for Climate. This is a global movement globally called Parents for Future. And these are people who educate the others about climate changes, about the causes of it and the consequences. And personally, I believe that education can really make change in the world. So I joined them, and yeah, I'm there for 4 years already now in the management position of the Parents for Climate Foundation.
Wow, really, really impressive. And I think absolutely you're right, because education is a key for changing systems, for changing ideas, for changing the idea of opportunities and chances to change something for the better, to not stick in the situation we are, right? What does real impact look like beyond headlines for you?
Yeah, this is a good question. For me, the real impact comes from consistency. And I have seen our movement, Parents for Climate, being developed from a small local, some small local actions. Now we're quite a big foundation that is invited by the ministries, by the municipalities, by the decision makers to be consulted with. And we do really great initiatives, like we have some big educational campaigns across the whole Poland. And we have a group of people that just drill and drill and drill with their message. And what I like the most is how we communicate. We don't talk just big abstract numbers. So we don't talk about how the climate change will affect the polar bears somewhere there in the world. We talk about our real examples, our local examples of our kids, our neighbors, the air quality around the schools, etc. Something that the other people just really experience. And I see that our message slowly gets through, and the decision makers, they start listening to it, then they start slowly making the change. And of course, it's really, really slow. And sometimes you might even get frustrated how slow it is. But when I zoom out from this, I see a movement of people who are just parents, who have their own jobs, who do everything, this everything they do in their free time, and they still can achieve something because of this consistency, because of showing up all the time, because of their courage to make these changes. And this is what the real impact is, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Seeing you, I see a mother of three. I see a CFO. I see a founder. I see a climate activist. I can imagine that sometimes there are days where you think, "Oh, I'm just a power woman. No matter, I can really move all this." But do you have also some hacks for you? How to keep energized? How to keep really powerful? Because I mean, I'm sometimes in similar situations, and on the one hand, I feel like, hey, it's great things I do, and I can move things for the better. But sometimes I have moments where I think, okay, good that I have my resources, because otherwise it could be too much.
Yeah, it is so sometimes. That's right. So first, I have support from the family. I have a husband who is very, very supportive. We split the responsibilities, and we also have grandparents that help us a lot. And I have no idea how we would do it without them, and how I would do it without the help of my husband as well. And what helps me also is a plant recovery. One thing that works very well for us, me and my husband, is that we plan a solo weekend for each of us every other month. So one person takes care of the kids for the whole weekend, and the other goes somewhere, definitely out of home. And I really like this weekends, these moments, because I can reset. Sometimes I do yoga. I take yoga classes, yoga retreats. Sometimes I go somewhere with friends. Sometimes I stay with my sister for the whole weekend. And when I come back, I'm more focused. I have much more energy, and yeah, and that's it.
That's great. I think it's often the the rituals and the very easy but of course makeable things, the things which are not jump somewhere like if would be great if, but the things which are really doable, right? I mean, you said that you share also responsibilities with your husband. This is great. What do you think should women stop apologizing for?
Yeah, so I think that women, especially mothers, they should stop apologizing for being ambitious about their careers and not being perfect mothers at the same time. And because you can deeply care about your family and you can also deeply care about your work at the same time. And of course, there will be you will need to ch choose sometimes between one or the other, but the goal here is not to be perfect in everything. The goal is to make the choices and just own them. Whatever choice you make, you just have to own this.
What would you like, and just a small quick question, your children, if they have listened to this show in 20 years, what would you want them to hear about the choices you made today?
So, I would like them to know that I took this path, I took my career step by step. I worked a lot. I had to explore a lot to get where I am. And I did it with open mind and to whatever life brought on my way. And I regret nothing. I really regret nothing because every mistake taught me something and it shaped who I am right now. And if there's one message that I would like my kids to listen, or just the listeners to know, is that you don't need to be extraordinary to make a change or to achieve something. You just need to be curious, to just learn and keep learning all the time and just show up.
Thank you so much, Agatha, to give us so many insights into your life, your mission, and what drives you further, and some learnings also for people outside. Thank you for having you here. And that wraps up our episode of We Empower, the weekly radio show dedicated to celebrating the strength, resilience, and limitless potential of us, of all human around the globe. Join us again next week as we continue on this empowering journey, sharing real stories of triumph, upliftment, and empowerment. Your presence and engagement mean the world to us, and we appreciate you taking the time to tune in. Thank you for being part of our community. Until next time, keep shining and empowering others. Together, we rise. Thank you.